Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, the strict constructionist doubleheader today. We'll hear from Muin Rabbani on the Gaza war and the politics of Israel-Palestine generally, and then from the economist Stephanie Stancheva on how much people hate inflation and why. There's a lot of mystification and misinformation in the media about the Middle East. Here's someone to cut through the nonsense and get to the major points. He's Muin Rabbani, someone with a broad understanding of the politics of the region, especially Israel-Palestine. He is co-editor of Jadalia, an e-zine that covers the region, where he also hosts his Connections podcast. Muin Rabbani. To start with, what is Israel's aim? They're clearly not wiping out Hamas, which reappears as soon as the IDF leaves town. They are wiping out Gaza as a civilization. Is the wiping out the real aim, or is Bibi just trying to stay out of jail, and Gaza is collateral damage to him? How do you read it?
There's the formally announced aims. There is also what I would say are the informal aims that have been enunciated, but not necessarily as formal policy. And then there are also hidden aims. So the formal aims are first and foremost to eradicate Hamas, to basically destroy its military capabilities and its ability to govern the Gaza Strip. And later, a second formal objective was added, and that was to return the captives that were taken on October 7th to Israel. And as many people have pointed out, those two aims are kind of in contradiction with each other, because as we've seen over the past 8 months, returning the captives requires negotiations. Negotiations require an at least temporary ceasefire. And after the 1 week ceasefire at the end of November resulted in an intensification of Israel's onslaught on the Gaza Strip, Hamas's demand now is for a permanent ceasefire for any exchange. Then there's the informal aims, and those are, like you've said, basically the sowing death and destruction in the Gaza Strip on a scale that the Palestinians are either forced out, quote-unquote, voluntarily leave, and failing that, that the Gaza Strip is made unfit for human habitation. So we've seen, for example, the systematic destruction of civilian infrastructure in the Gaza Strip. And then there are also hidden aims, which is, as many people have pointed out, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has a vested interest in the continuation of this conflict, because so long as Israel is in crisis, the various legal proceedings against him can't really be concluded. And while I think that's true, I don't think that's the driving force behind Israel's onslaught on the Gaza Strip, because I think it stretches credulity a bit to think that the entire Israeli government and that the entire Israeli security establishment has for 8 months been prosecuting this war in the full knowledge that they're doing so simply to keep an increasingly unpopular leader in power. And I would point out that just like Netanyahu, there are other key leaders in Israel, the defense minister, for example, and the security establishment, who feel that by continuing to prosecute this war until they actually achieve something meaningful, they would like to do so in order to, let's say, recapture their honor that was lost so dramatically on October 7th. There are also other aims. Israel has this doctrine of what it calls maintaining deterrence, which basically means striking fear into the hearts of its adversaries and anyone else who might be watching in order to dissuade them from attacking Israel. And part of this is making an example out of the Gaza Strip, so that no other adversary will ever dare think of doing something similar. And that, of course, seen strictly from an Israeli perspective, has been quite counterproductive, because rather than others putting their tails between their legs and running away, we've seen Hezbollah in Lebanon, Houthis in Yemen, militias in Iraq, most recently Iran with its unprecedented missile salvo against Israel, acting anything but deterred by Israel's conduct in the Gaza Strip.
So which is your preferred explanation? How do those reasons stack up?
Well, I do think that Israel genuinely wants to crush Hamas. I also think that Israel is incapable of doing so. I also think that Israel genuinely intends to make the Gaza Strip unfit for human habitation, and it seems to be doing a pretty good job of it. I also think Israel genuinely believes that it is reestablishing its posture of deterrence vis-a-vis other adversaries in the region. So I don't think there's one simple explanation. But I do think that if we look at how this conflict has developed over the past 8 months, I think you can also see, for example, that a lust for revenge was absolutely central to Israel's conduct of this war during the first few months. I mean, the absolutely insane levels of violence, of bombing, of killing, of destruction, I don't think really can be explained by looking for a coherent or rational strategy, unless one figures an insane lust for revenge into the equation.
I saw a recent interview with you where you were speculating the U.S. military must be watching their Israeli counterparts with alarm as they struggle unsuccessfully to subdue Hamas in a rather small piece of territory. Could you expand on that and what it might mean for Israel and the U.S.-Israel alliance?
The U.S.-Israel alliance is based on a number of factors, but I would argue that the most important one is one that emerged during the Cold War in the late 1960s and late 1970s, through which Israel was seen by the United States as a reliable guardian of U.S. interests in the Middle East. And it was seen so primarily on the basis of its military might. And what we've seen now, and we saw it also in previous instances, for example, the 2006 Lebanon War, is that while the Israeli military may be a very effective killing machine, it's not a particularly competent fighting force anymore. I mean, the days when it could conquer the Sinai on behalf of Britain and France in the space of 48 hours, as it did in 1956, or defeat three Arab armies, as it did in 1967 with Egypt, Syria, and Jordan, those days are long gone. What we're seeing now is Israel for 8 months trying to get the best of what is at the end of the day a second-order militia using primarily locally manufactured weapons in a postage-stamp-sized territory, the Gaza Strip, which is all of 365 square kilometers, and failing to do so. And my view is that for those who, in the United States, and particularly in its military establishment, who look at Israel primarily as a military asset, as an intelligence asset, this can't but have a very significant negative consequence for their assessment of that relationship and Israel's value to U.S. regional and geopolitical strategy.
Now, with the Cold War long over, does Israel's strategic role still serve a useful purpose?
Well, I would argue that it doesn't, and that we saw this, in fact, at the very conclusion of the Cold War with the Kuwait crisis, you know, the first Gulf crisis in 1990-91, where Iraq invaded and annexed Kuwait on the 2nd of August 1990. The U.S. then sought to assemble a global and regional coalition to expel the Iraqi military from Kuwait, and it was able to bring on not only its traditional Arab client states like Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and so on, but it was also able to recruit Syria, which had been very much in the Soviet camp during the Cold War, and an absolute condition for it doing so was to keep Israel out of this coalition rather than as part of it. Then, when the war started and Iraq fired a number of Scud missiles at Israel, a U.S. priority became preventing Israel from retaliating. So Israel was not, for example, provided with the military codes that would help U.S. aircraft identify it as friend or foe. So rather than Israel performing a service for the U.S., the U.S. had to expend considerable energy on preventing Israel from any involvement in that crisis. And that, I think, is in some sense emblematic of how things have developed since then. After 9/11, for example, yes, you know, Israel did perform certain intelligence services that proved valuable to the U.S., although it's my understanding that many U.S. intelligence leaders saw the contribution of, for example, Jordan in particular, but also others in the region, as more valuable. And then when the Bush administration had this idea of a new Middle East, well, a key element of that in 2006 was the Israeli attack on Lebanon, which Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice famously characterized as the birth pangs of the Middle East. The problem is it was an abortion because Israel failed and there was no Middle East. And in the end, the U.S. had to transition from encouraging Israel to achieve a quick and decisive victory to, in the end, accepting a ceasefire because Israel couldn't finish the job.
Most American presidents have been very loyal and supportive of Israel, but Biden seems to take it to a new level. What do you make of what he's about and what do they want out of this war?
As you said, Biden is on a whole nother level with his passionate attachment to Israel. I think there are several factors at play here. One is if you look at his career, he spent most of his political life in Congress. And Congress, of course, has always been a hotbed of support for Israel. And in the period where he was a prominent senator, it bears recollection that the mainstay of U.S. support for Israel in Congress were not the right-wing Republicans who, you know, in the 70s and 80s could often be associated with, for example, the oil lobby and taking account of the sensitivities of Arab client regimes and so on. But it was really the liberal wing of the Democratic Party that was the mainstay of U.S. support for Israel. So that, I think, is part of it. Biden also came of political age during this period we were discussing earlier that saw Israel as a so-called stationary aircraft carrier serving U.S. interests in the Middle East. And I think associated with this also is a genuine contempt for Arabs and for Palestinians in particular, which has been, I think, quite prominent in the U.S. Political system. I think Biden exemplifies those sections of the U.S. political class that really looks at Palestinians as irrelevant and expendable human scum, and who simply, even if their life depended on it, couldn't bring themselves to show even a minimum of empathy.
Biden can't even utter a single pro forma word of sympathy for Palestinians. It's really shocking.
He gives the impression of someone who couldn't do it even if he wanted to. Even if it was politically expedient for him to do so, he wouldn't be able to do that. And I think, again, this reflects the political milieu in which he was raised and in which he was and in which he operated for so much of his political career. And I'm sure, you know, if you were to turn the clock back 30 or 40 years or whatever, Biden may stand out today, but he would have been almost, how would I call it, unobtrusive, because his attitudes that we're seeing today were kind of so typical among liberal Democrats during that earlier era.
I'm speaking with the Middle East analyst Muin Rabbani. Friday morning, New York Times, we saw attacks deep into Lebanon. What is Israel trying to do, and how do you think Hezbollah is going to respond to that?
Well, we've seen unprecedentedly deep Israeli attacks into Lebanon and unprecedentedly deep Hezbollah attacks into Israel. This essentially goes back to October 7th. You know, you had the Hamas attacks into Israel. You had the beginning of what I think most people would today characterize as a genocidal Israeli onslaught on the Gaza Strip. And October 8th, Hezbollah began carrying out attacks on Israel, not so much to open a second front in the sense of all-out war. It's been a process of what has been, I think, accurately described as controlled escalation, but basically carrying out attacks on Israel as kind of a supportive front and making clear that these attacks will not cease unless and until Israel ends its offensive on the Gaza Strip. Very similar to what the Houthis have been doing in Yemen, for example. Now, The problem here is that on the one hand, it may well be the case that both Israel and Hezbollah have chosen controlled escalation as their strategy, but that doesn't necessarily mean it won't get out of control. And the second issue is that you also have significant forces within Israel, who I would associate perhaps most prominently with Israel's Minister of Defense, Yoav Gallant, who still feel that Israel has an unsettled account in Lebanon going back to 2006 and its military failures at that time. And the risk here, I would say, is that Gallant is seen as something of a gambler, a risk taker. And he may well, at a certain point, in contradiction to everyone's reading of the situation on the ground, choose for a significant offensive against Hezbollah. Now, the Israelis, you know, have repeatedly been making this threat. Gallant and others keep saying we can do to Beirut what we can do to Gaza. That's probably true, but Hezbollah can also do to Tel Aviv a lot of what Israel has done to Gaza.
Yeah, I mean, they didn't do very well against them 18 years ago. So, and they're not any weaker now than they were 18 years ago.
No, I would say Hezbollah is very significantly stronger than it was in 2006. But I would not go so far as to say that Israel is stronger as well. Sure, it has increased capabilities. But as we've seen in Gaza, it would probably have even more trouble against Hezbollah today than it did in 2006.
What is the underlying reason for Israel's deteriorating military performance?
I'm not sure I'm qualified to answer that question. I'm not a military analyst, but my sense is that it reflects changes in Israeli society. It certainly reflects a transition within Israeli military doctrine of looking at technology as a catch-all solution to all its challenges. And we saw this very clearly on October 7th. A lot of critics of Israel's failure on October 7th suggested that the problem was that Israel had relocated sections of its armed forces from Gaza to the West Bank in order to more intensively colonize the West Bank, and that this was somehow a political failure. I don't agree with that. The reason that there were insufficient numbers of troops on the Gaza border on October 7th had very little to do with the West Bank. It had everything to do with Israel's conviction that it had found a technological solution to any potential security challenges emerging out of Gaza. And the technology was specifically designed to reduce the burden on the military, on the soldiers. So yes, of course, Israel has a priority of intensifying the colonization of the West Bank, but that's not why the Gaza boundary was so sparsely defended on October 7th. The reason was that Israel was convinced it had found a technological substitute for actual soldiers. And you could see that, for example, with the so-called iron wall barrier with automated machine guns and cameras and all the rest of it. But again, Israel had insufficiently invested, for example, in the training of its soldiers and had put too much store into intelligence and technology and all the rest of it. And the other thing, of course, is the Israeli military has, to a significant extent, been transformed into kind of a colonial police force, where the mission it's training for is going after school kids in the alleyways of West Bank towns and refugee camps, rather than dealing with serious military adversaries. And to the extent that it prepares for more extensive wars, it's to bomb Iran, but not for the kinds of scenarios that we've been seeing unfold since October of last year.
Well, you anticipated my next question, Iran. To the U.S. and Israel, Iran seems to be behind everything evil in the region. But what is Iran's role, and would Israel like to provoke it into a war?
Israel's dream would be provoking a direct confrontation between the United States and Iran in the context of the current crisis. And I think they may well believe that they've found their preferred flunky in Joe Biden, but I suspect he would have to deal with significant pushback from the Pentagon and the military leadership. Iran is a member, most prominent member, of what's called the Axis of Resistance. This is a coalition of states and movements in the region who share an agenda of opposing U.S. hegemony and Israeli influence and seek to reduce it. It includes Iran, Syria, Hamas, Hezbollah, various militias in the region, and the Houthis in Yemen. This is being presented as kind of a thoroughly coherent octopus that is being directed from Iran, and all the others are merely Iranian proxies. In reality, it's quite different. So, for example, yes, it's true that Iran enjoys unprecedented influence in Syria since the conflict in Syria broke out. But before that, Syria was in a much more powerful position vis-a-vis Iran in their bilateral relationship. And Hamas, I think, is a particularly interesting member of this coalition. Yes, it is a member of the Axis of Resistance. But in 2011, 2012, at the beginning of the Syria conflict, the Hamas leadership, which was then based in Damascus, broke with the Assad government in Syria and relocated to Doha in Qatar. Qatar, of course, hardly a member of the Axis of Resistance and a close U.S. ally, and hosts the largest U.S. Air Force base outside of the U.S., I believe. That led to a rupture of relations with Iran as well that were really only repaired during the past decade. And if U.S. and Israeli intelligence are to be believed, Hamas did not coordinate its October 7th attacks with either Hezbollah or Iran, and didn't even inform them of the date of these attacks. If you look at this coalition as a whole, you have some members that would probably fit the characterization of Iranian proxies, and this would include some of the militias, smaller militias in Iraq. You have others like Hezbollah, which are ideologically aligned with Iran very closely, but function very autonomously from it and make their own decisions based much more on the Lebanese context than Iranian interests. And then you have others like Hamas, which in a sense has one foot in this coalition and one foot outside it. So it's very convenient, you know, just as a few decades ago, we would have ascribed every action by a whole host of actors as responding to orders from the Kremlin rather than responding to local factors and seeking to implement their own autonomous or independent agenda. Similarly, it's now very convenient to say, well, these people don't really have legitimate grievances of their own. It's only because they're following Iranian orders that all of this is happening.
And finally, Egypt. There seem to be some growing tensions between those neighbors. What's going on there?
Egypt, as you know, has been at peace with Israel since 1979. It was often described as a cold peace, but during the past decade, it became an increasingly warm peace after General Abdel Fattah al-Sisi seized power in Egypt, and he was facing an insurgency in the Sinai Peninsula. Began cooperating very closely with Israel. There are all kinds of reports that the Israeli Air Force was actually carrying out air raids in the Sinai Peninsula on behalf of Egypt. And Egypt initially had an extremely hostile relationship with Hamas, which already then was governing the Gaza Strip. And at one point, there were even suggestions that the Egyptian military might invade the Gaza Strip to get rid of Hamas. But in the end, despite coming from very different ideological backgrounds and despite their hostility, they both came to the conclusion that they needed each other. Egypt felt that the only alternative to continued Hamas rule in Gaza was a vacuum that would make Gaza a foothold, for example, for the Sinai insurgents and ISIS and those types of groups. And Hamas, despite its hostility to Egypt, came to the recognition that, you know, the only border, non-Israeli border it shares, its only window to the outside world is Egypt, and that it had to deal with Egypt on the basis of its needs and interests rather than its ideological preferences. Now, you fast forward to 2023, 2024, Egypt was somewhat hesitant about the Israeli offensive to begin with. It, of course, has cooperated with it closely in terms of the blockade of the Gaza Strip and all the rest of it. But so long as Israel did not take any clear measures to try to force the Palestinians into the Sinai Peninsula. Egypt was basically prepared to look the other way and just posture and denounce the war. Now, it has been a central principle of Egyptian national security since 1979 not to take responsibility for the Gaza Strip off of Israel's hands. Israel has repeatedly tried to entice the Egyptians to take over their Gaza problem, if you will, and the Egyptians have consistently refused.
There's nothing in it for them to do so, right?
There's, well, except for solving an Israeli headache, and the Egyptian position has been, yes, there is a very simple solution to the challenge of Gaza, and that's called an end to occupation and the establishment of an independent Palestinian state, which Israel, of course, refuses. So what's happened in the past few weeks is Israel has not only begun attacking the southern Gaza town of Rafah, but has also taken over the Egyptian-Gaza border zone. And it did so without coordinating this with the Egyptians. Now, the Egyptians say that on the one hand, this is a violation of the Israeli-Egyptian 1979 peace treaty, which placed clear limits on the number of armed forces that could be on the Israeli/Palestinian side of the border. And the Egyptians would say, you know, when we needed additional armed forces in Sinai to battle the insurgency, we coordinated this with the Israelis and made sure to get their approval before we did so. And Israel is now acting without consulting or coordinating with us. And second of all, the Egyptians also see this as a violation of the 2005 agreements that came into being after Israel disengaged from the Gaza Strip. But I think more broadly, this reflects genuine Egyptian fears that Israel is creating conditions in the Gaza Strip and in Rafah particularly that will leave Palestinians no choice but to cross the border into Egypt. And this is something they absolutely refuse. And they seem to have met deaf ears in the Israeli government. And that's why you're now seeing, for example, Egypt joining South Africa's case against Israel under the Genocide Convention at the International Court of Justice. Egypt apparently unilaterally sending further armed forces into Sinai and becoming increasingly vocal about its opposition to Israel's offensive. And a further factor, of course, is that Egypt, along with Qatar, are the main mediators in trying to arrange a ceasefire and exchange of captives. And the Egyptians have apparently concluded that Israel is not negotiating seriously, that it's just participating in these discussions to gain time and for show. And that also, I think, reflects Egypt's frustrations.
That was Muin Rabbani, who is, among many things, co-editor of Jadalia, an e-zine on Middle Eastern affairs. The interview was recorded on Friday, May 17th, before the International Criminal Court prosecutor recommended the indictment of the Israeli leadership and some principal figures in Hamas. I asked Muin for a comment, and here's what he said. On 20 May, the ICC prosecutor, Karim Khan, issued applications to the court's pretrial chamber to issue warrants of arrest for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, Defense Minister Yoav Gallant, and three Hamas leaders, the head of the Politburo, Ismail Haniya, its leader in Gaza, Yahya Sinwar, and the commander of its military wing, Mohammed Deif. The ICC developments, together with the ICJ genocide case, represent a strategic setback for Israel, which has for decades enjoyed impunity in its dealings with the Palestinian people. Given that Israel is much more dependent on relations with ICC member states, these indictments also represent a much more serious threat to Israel than they do to Hamas. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break. Thank you. Some of Maurice Ravel's Serenade Grotesque, his first piece for piano, performed by Bertrand Chamayou. Next, inflation, a topic that makes many liberals and leftists uncomfortable. To express distaste for it is seen as something rich people are likely to do, even though it affects those who have a hard time making ends meet, far more severely than the comfortable. Back in 1997, the economist Robert Shiller did a survey in the U.S., Germany, and Brazil on the topic and found that people really hate inflation. But that was 27 years ago. How do they feel about it now? Stephanie Stancheva, Nathaniel Rope's professor of political economy at Harvard, along with a couple of colleagues, recently published the results of a survey that updates Shiller's. Even though the economic environment has changed, their feelings were little changed. They still hate inflation, and for similar reasons. Here with more is Stephanie Stancheva. Before we get to your work, let's just talk briefly about Robert Shiller's 1997 survey. Could you say what he found and what he did?
Absolutely. So in a really interesting paper in 1997, Robert Shiller set out to answer this longstanding question to which we still, you know, are looking for answers, which is why do people dislike inflation? And he used a small-scale survey where he tried to understand why people dislike it, how they think about it. And his key finding is that people dislike inflation because they think it lowers their living standards. And they tend to associate inflation with lots of bad things, a bad economy, bad social and political consequences, tend to think that inflation eats up their living standard because employers do not address their wages sufficiently. And so it is something that is interesting to study today because the economy has changed, lots of different things have happened. And so I was curious to see whether these findings are still valid today.
It does seem like there's a lot of continuity over the last almost three decades.
It is actually really interesting. So the core findings, you know, that the predominant reason for why people dislike inflation is that they believe it diminishes their buying power and that their wages don't keep up with the pace of rising prices is still very, very much there. And it's still also true that many people believe that firms have a lot of considerable discretion in setting their wages. So when wages are not adjusted by your employer, many people say it's because the employer chooses not to do so. So it is not the case that people generally think employers will be subject to market forces making them adjust or making them raise the wages. So that part is still completely true. And similarly, inflation is associated with lots of negative economic outcomes. So for instance, it's perceived that inflation and high unemployment go hand in hand, a view that is much more consistent with stagflation episodes, rather than, you know, periods of high demand that then lead to inflation. But there's also differences here. One thing that Shiller could not really look at, for instance, is the answers by political leaning. And today we see actually substantial polarization in both the perceived causes of inflation, in the attitude towards what should be done along party lines, as well as to a lesser extent across income groups. But really the biggest divide is along political leaning. So that is something that is very interesting to look at today.
It's interesting the timing of this. Shiller did his survey 15 or 20 years into a long disinflation. You did yours after a rather anomalous bout of inflation. Do you see any effects of the different economic environments in the results?
Well, clearly, like, the core conclusions are still there. So that is very much still the case. We can see, you know, some variations due to how the economy has evolved. For instance, in Shiller's survey, in the mid-90s, people said that inflation makes comparison shopping harder. And today, that's not something that people really mention. So perhaps today it's much easier, whether through online shopping or, you know, delivery services or just more information to actually do that. So there's some small differences like that. But overall, I would say it is just fascinating how stable some of these attitudes are.
You alluded to something that he found that you also found, the increased complexity of just making daily economic decisions. Could you expand on that?
Yeah, so I do dig in detail into why people feel affected in their different roles. And by different roles, I mean that inflation affects us as consumers through the goods and services we purchase. It affects us as employees and workers through our jobs, our wages, our labor market experience. Also as asset holders, we have different compositions of debts on the one hand and assets on the other hand, and so we will be differently affected because of that. And then a fourth role is maybe just as human beings, there's clearly an emotional or stress response to inflation too. So I'm trying to explore all these, the impact across all these dimensions and also how people react in response. And what I see is that one of the major consequences of inflation is that people think it makes their decisions just much more complex. And that, I think, captures two things. One is that as people feel their living standards are declining, it does require somewhat tougher and harder choices. And then also, just because of the evolution of prices, it does require a constant rethinking and rebudgeting of your daily life, and that imposes an extra cognitive cost and just extra burden on households. So that is a reason that is really, really mentioned a lot. And we can see that they also report taking lots of costly actions to deal with inflation, whether it's delaying purchases, changing the quality of goods they buy, the quantity of goods they buy. And so there's a lot of costly adjustments that do happen indeed.
What about the relation to wages? It is an empirical fact that over the decades, as inflation rises, wages generally lag and real wages decline. Do people understand this? How do they see the relation?
One thing that I ask people is how long they think it would take for their wage to catch up if inflation increases. And lots of people think it's going to take quite a while. So, you know, more than a year, sometimes even two. And so as a result, there's clearly a perception of even if things do eventually catch up, there's a long period during which living standards are going to be declining. What I do find really, really interesting is also the way people then perceive wage increases. So in the sample, lots of people did report receiving wage increases during this whole inflationary period. But when I asked them for the reason why they got that wage increase, actually a lot of people will not attribute it to inflation adjustments. And obviously, I don't know why they received a wage increase. I cannot see exactly all the reasons, but they will tend to say it's mainly due to job performance or career progression, especially so if they have switched jobs. And so the wage increase happened during a job switch. You know, they will not attribute that wage increase to inflationary adjustments. So there is perhaps a little bit of an asymmetry where we feel like the loss in purchasing power is very much driven by inflation, but increases in wages during this whole inflationary period are only rarely attributed to primarily inflation.
And what about the distributional effects? How do experiences and opinions vary by income level?
There's some really big differences here that we can see in two ways. So in a sense, inflation is very much perceived as an inequality, an increasing phenomenon, and induces a sense of inequity. So first, you know, along all these margins I mentioned, as consumers, as workers, as asset holders, also emotionally, we can see that the lower income respondents in the sample are more affected and report making many more adjustments. In addition, there's a very clear perception among many, many respondents that the wages of higher income people are actually growing faster than others during inflationary times, and so are much better able to keep pace with inflation. So there is a concern that inflation is increasing inequality. And here too, we can see, you know, there's quite a bit of a partisan gap actually, where that inequality concern due to inflation is much more widespread among Democrat respondents than among Republican respondents.
Did that partisan difference remain even after you control for income?
Yes, it does remain. So it is very much an additional dimension that is there, that is even conditional within income groups. Your political leaning will be predictive of your views on inflation.
Now, if there was a period in 2021 and 22 where wages rose more quickly at the low end of the high, did people have any sense of that? A lot of liberals really emphasize that differential, but did people feel that?
So I did not ask specifically, you know, about that episode, but I do get a lot, you know, this question about do people perceive things correctly? You know, what do they perceive, et cetera? And, I want to mention something that's really, really important to me, which is that the way we measure inflation is obviously not perfect, right? It's quite difficult to measure this correctly and not trivial by any means. And so we have to make some choices, and typically what we tend to measure tends to be very coarse average measures of inflation. And so it's very possible that the perceptions that people have of inflation, they're more aligned with their own experience, and those might not be extremely aligned with the official statistics or these average numbers that are out there. There's at least two reasons for that. One is what's called inflation inequality, which is that people with different incomes basically consume different baskets of goods, and those do not evolve in the same way. So, for instance, if, you know, among lower income respondents, a larger share of their budget is taken up by energy prices or gas prices, they're going to feel any gas price increase much more effectively than, you know, a higher income person. And that's true for many other goods. And another reason is that there's ways we have to deal with financing costs or home ownership. It's a choice. It's not perfect. There is no perfect solution how to treat it. as a consumption good or investment good. And the key point is that this can also introduce a wedge between someone's experience and what's actually captured by the official statistics.
I'm speaking with the economist Stephanie Stancheva. So how do people explain inflation?
There's quite a range of causes that people perceive. And here too, there's quite a bit of a partisan gap. When I ask people, you know, what are the major causes of inflation, in a very open-ended way, so without providing them with a list of options, just speak freely, what comes out a lot on top is things related to the government. And, you know, among Republican respondents, they will very specifically mention Joe Biden and the current administration. Democrats will not necessarily mention the current administration, but they will mention, you know, government policy, spending, etc. So much less so than Republicans, but they will also mention it. Another thing that comes out a lot is this idea of greed. So greed as a word itself comes up when people are asked to write freely. That comes up much more on the Democrat side, and it's typically related to actions by businesses and firms.
The greed thing is funny because, you know, greed is a constant in our economic system, but sometimes it shows up, as it did in that 2 year or so bout of inflation, and it goes away. Other times it's not something I quite understand.
Yeah, so clearly it's something that is quite top of mind, especially among more Democrat-leaning respondents when it comes to the causes of inflation. If I drill a bit further into these categories, what we can see is that people tend to associate the recent inflation episodes with specific types of government actions, and actually quite a bit with foreign assistance and the war. So that is something that comes up, you know, as a very specific cause quite a lot. And then a third thing that comes up quite predominantly is increases in the cost of production because of oil prices or energy prices. And that is something that people mention quite a bit too.
Now, most economists talk about a trade-off between inflation and unemployment. Does the general public think this way?
This trade-off that economists talk about, it's not a fixed law. It happens in, you know, in some cases. So we have episodes where basically the economy is doing very well. Unemployment is low. There's a lot of demand, and that triggers inflation. And then, you know, we figure out that there's a trade-off between trying to reduce inflation and sort of dampening economic activity or dampening demand. So trying to cool the economy. But there's periods where there's just productivity shocks or increases in energy prices that drive at the same time unemployment and high inflation. These are the periods that we call stagflation, where there's a conjunction of bad shocks and economic events that make inflation coexist with actually low productivity, high unemployment, etc. So we know about both these cases, and it's a bit of an empirical question how often one or the other happens. But what is very, very interesting is that when I ask people about these trade-offs and about the link, for instance, between inflation and unemployment, it's very unambiguous that people believe when there's high inflation, there's high unemployment. So these two things really go hand in hand. So people hold a view that's just very clearly consistent with a stagflation situation, where inflation is just linked to a bad economy very unambiguously. And this is true also if I ask them about the trade-offs for policymakers. So if I ask them, to what extent is it necessary to reduce, for instance, economic growth or economic activity in order to dampen inflation, or to what extent is it necessary to increase unemployment to dampen inflation, the answer is generally it's not necessary at all. People believe it's possible to reduce inflation without hurting economic activity.
Do people see any positives to inflation, for example, eroding the real value of debt?
That's a really great question, and I did want to ask them about this. So I have this open-ended question, again, where people can just answer freely, and only a really tiny minority of respondents is able to find anything here. And typically, it's not at all what you might think about. It's more things like, okay, it forces people to budget, for instance. It is really a tiny minority that is able to come up with any positive effect of inflation.
You say among low-income respondents, 57% believe that inflation has made it harder to repay their debts, which is interesting. It seems that people live in a flow world and not a stock world. They don't think about the real value of the principal. They just think about servicing the debt from day to day and month to month.
Mm-hmm. Which is a very relevant consideration. I think it goes back to what I was mentioning before. Maybe some of our official statistics are not able to capture the sort of day-to-day experience when people feel like their living standard itself is declining and currently their basket of goods has become much more expensive. It makes it harder for them in the moment to repay their mortgage, to repay other loans, especially if they feel like their wages are lagging. If you ask people what type of emotions do they feel when they think about inflation or rising prices, it's obviously predominantly negative, and it's emotions such as anger, stress, fear about the future and about their circumstances. So it's clearly something that does trigger an emotional cost and a stress cost.
Economists are more likely to look at rates of change, the inflation rate, from month to month, year to year. And so as inflation has come down from 9% to under 4%, that's seen as a substantial reduction. It seems the general public thinks more about levels. Food is very expensive, and it isn't coming down. I have to admit, I feel that every time I shop for food, which is almost every day. So yes. Are economists really missing some of how people perceive the effects of inflation by just looking at rates of change?
Yes, I think the rates of change are very relevant, you know, for monetary policy, for instance. So there is a good reason to look at them. It's sort of when monetary policy changes, that's a good metric to think about, is this going in the right direction or not? But it does not capture the people's experience, which depends on, you know, how much can they currently afford or not. So there is definitely a little bit of a disconnect there.
I've long thought there's a social dimension to the dislike of inflation, a sense that things are out of control, values are deteriorating. Did you find anything along those lines?
Yes, indeed. There's a lot of broader consequences from inflation that people perceive. And I'm glad you're asking, because I mentioned, you know, the most important one is, according to people, that it makes household decision-making more complex. And that's clearly there. But the second most important is actually that there is increases in inequality and a lack of social cohesion, so a deterioration of social cohesion. So clearly there are these broader impacts that are perceived from inflation, and that is something that is obviously not always taken into account.
How does inflation rank as a political issue, and how does it compare to, say, unemployment?
So it ranks really, really high, actually. So you can look at, you know, among economic policy issues or among like social policy issues, and it consistently ranks really, really high. Basically, many respondents will put it at the top. I was really curious about this to dig in more detail in this, and I did what's called a conjoint experiment, where you can basically, you know, ask people to pick between different economies. Which economy would you prefer to live in over the next year? And each economy has a given unemployment rate and a given inflation rate. And you present people with different pairs of such economies, and they have to pick. I prefer, you know, 5% inflation with 3% unemployment to, for instance, 6% inflation and 7% unemployment. From those answers, you can actually estimate the implicit weight that people put on inflation relative to unemployment. And what I find is that the weight on inflation is basically twice as high as the weight on unemployment. I don't have the exact answer why that's the case, but one hypothesis I have is that unless you're experiencing unemployment directly yourself, it is something that is not immediately affecting your life. Inflation is something that almost everyone perceives, so it has a widespread set of losers from it, while unemployment losses are very concentrated. It's among the people who do lose their job. It is only the people who are unemployed who will feel that loss to that extent, while inflation is sort of felt by everyone.
Inflation is experienced by almost 100% of the population, whereas an increase in unemployment might be experienced by only 3 or 4% of the population.
Exactly.
What about policies? What do people prefer? They seem to think, you said they don't like monetary tightening. They seem to agree with Turkish President Erdogan that higher interest rates means higher inflation and vice versa. What do they see as a cure?
Yes, that's a really great question, because I did find this slightly puzzling thing that people do think, for instance, that increases in interest rates are definitely not a good way to deal with inflation. And this is actually a little bit correlated with the perception when I ask them what will happen after specific economic events or specific policy changes. People tend to think that an increase in interest rate actually leads to higher inflation, so that policy view is very consistent with that. When I try to dig into different types of policies and how supported they might be, things related to monetary tightening are not that highly supported. What is much more supported is basically reductions in government debt, consistent with the idea that the government is perceived as one of the major causes of inflation. So reductions in government debt are quite supported, especially when it's financed in progressive ways, such as, for instance, increasing taxes on higher income, not by reducing spending on social programs. That is really not the way that people think things should go. And then the other set of policies that are really, really highly supported relate to basically businesses. So things like tightening antitrust regulation to basically increase competition between firms, increases in corporate taxes, also quite popular, as well as a third type of policy, which is freezing the prices of essentials.
And how do people adapt?
So people adapt in many different ways, and especially the biggest adaptations are in their role as consumers. So there's a whole range of actions people take, especially lower income respondents. So higher income respondents also say they take some actions, but it's really quite unequally distributed. So lower income respondents report taking many more actions, such as decreasing the quantity of goods they buy, delaying purchases, which, by the way, is quite interesting because it's not the case, for instance, that people will stockpile or try to anticipate purchases ahead of rising inflation. Rather, people have to delay purchases, even purchases of essentials. And then they reduce the quality, so they pick lower quality goods, and those are, you know, actions that they take to try to buffer these impacts.
It's interesting that the policy that people would favor, higher taxes on business, for example, that was just not at all in our political conversation. The only thing we're really capable of right now is manipulating interest rates. It seems that any changes in taxes is just barely in the discourse.
It is interesting that people definitely, because there's these two perceived causes. One is basically actions by businesses. You know, we spoke about that idea of greed that was mentioned a lot. And actions by the government are considered super, super important. The policy views align with that. People want things to be done to reduce the government debt, including increasing taxes, but not cutting services or spending, social spending. And then they do want actions on the business side to stop what they perceive to be greed. So the policy views are very consistent, in a sense, with the perceived causes.
That was Stephanie Stancheva, Nathaniel Ropes, professor of political economy at Harvard, who's been researching public attitudes towards inflation. Her summary of public preferences for anti-inflation policies, like taxing businesses and the rich, for example, is very interesting. Too bad they get so little attention from the political class. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go with this sum of money, that's what I want, covered by the Flying Lizards in 1979. Till next week, bye.
In life for free, but you can give them to the birds and bees. I want the money. That's what I want. That's what I want. That's what I want. Your love gives me such a thrill, but your love won't pay my bills. I want money.